Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. Before I introduce our guest today, just a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, everybody, please check your cell phones now. Make sure the ringers are off. We do record these events for YouTube, and it's such a nuisance when people can't properly hear a particularly interesting remark because somebody's phone was going off. With that, let me tell you about our next two events coming up. This Thursday, we have Dr. Gino Strada. He is a well-known anti-war activist and also a specialist in medical issues relating to conflicts. He is the founder of Emergency, and he will be speaking this Thursday. After him next week, we're all quiet during the week following Easter, and then the following Monday, which would be April 8, we will have Usha Haley, and she is a professor of international business in New Zealand, and she is the author of a book that some of you may have already heard about entitled Game Changer, How Subsidies to Chinese Industry Altered the World as We Knew It. And she's an economist, and she and her husband, co-author George Haley from the States, will both be here for that event on April 8. With that, let me introduce our guest today. I think many of you probably remember his name from SARS a decade ago when he played a key role in unraveling the mysteries of the SARS virus. He's also been very prominent in looking at some of the issues with bird flu. He is now the scientific director of the Hong Kong University Pasteur Research Pole. He's also the director of the Center of Influenza Research at Hong Kong University. And with that, I give you Dr. Malik Perez. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to come and talk to you today. And the title that I was given by Keith is Emerging Infectious Diseases in Asia, What Comes Next? So of course, epidemics and pandemics will come. And I guess it's important for us to try to anticipate or try to risk assess. Will such a thing occur? If so, what will it be? And most importantly, what should we do to deal with such events? By the way, I should apologize. It just so happens that a lot of my images come from Time magazine. It's nothing to do with any partiality to Time magazine. It just so happens that they seem to have some interesting images that I capture for my talk. So coming back to this, but telling the future, of course, is foretelling the future is something that is beyond most of us. It was Yogi Berra who said that it's tough making predictions, especially about the future. We are all very good in rationalizing things after they have happened to explain this is what happened, but actually being accurate about things that are going to happen is tough, not just for infectious disease people. I mean, the economists don't do much better either. So how do we try to address such a question of epidemics and pandemics? What should we be looking out for, which I guess is what you have in mind? Clearly, we need to go back to the past and learn from past track record, what has happened in the past. So in this slide, what you see is going back over the last 30 or 40 years, new emerging infection episodes that have occurred worldwide. And the first thing you can see is that, of course, Asia doesn't have a monopoly on these events. So clearly we have mad cow disease or BSC in UK. We have West Nile virus in the USA. We have a lot of scary things coming out of Africa, Ebola, Marburg, etc. And in Asia, we had SARS, of course, we had avian flu, we have Nipah, we had Nipah and we still have it. In Australia, there's Hendra virus that keeps on popping its head up from time to time, continues to do so. Outbreaks of a new virus called Chandipura in India. So, as I said, these are happening all over the world. Is there any pattern that we can discern from this? One is that most of these new infections that come to humans come from animals. So they are zoonoses. The second is, if you look at these particular viruses or bacteria, most of them are RNA viruses. Now, that may be a bit technical, but viruses can be DNA viruses or RNA viruses. And the fact is that RNA viruses are much more mutable, they're much more adaptive than DNA viruses. So it's intuitive, therefore, that viruses that are able to jump species from another host and adapt in humans need to be nimble on their feet. So we could predict that the next outbreaks are going to be zoonoses coming from animals, and very likely they belong to this broad group of RNA viruses. Examples of RNA viruses: HIV, influenza, the coronavirus, SARS or the new coronavirus you hear, hepatitis C, for example, those are some of them. So again, going from the past, we had HIV/AIDS, a disease we didn't know 50 years ago, causing such havoc worldwide. We have antibiotic resistance bacteria, which are causing major problems globally. We have examples such as SARS. And just to point out that SARS, as you know, emerged, spread worldwide within a matter of weeks, months, and disappeared. Did it disappear because of action taken, or whether it disappeared spontaneously is a matter for debate. Probably the actions taken did help. But what I want to point out is that there are, as you know, SARS belongs to the coronavirus family. Now, there are two other coronaviruses that all of us live with, two viruses that cause the common cold. Technically, they're called 229E and OC43. All of us have been infected with it. Now, these two viruses came to humans within the last 200 years. So they came from animals, one from bats, the other from cattle, and they have spread worldwide, obviously, and they are with us for the rest of our humankind's future. So these viruses do jump from animals. Some of them die out, such as SARS, but others stay with us. Fortunately, the common cold viruses are relatively mild. Another question is, will there be another pandemic of flu? We just had one. But again, if you go back to history, you see that every century there have been three or four influenza pandemics. So it is quite safe to say that there will be more than one pandemic, more to come this century. And also, if you look at where the pandemics of the past have emerged, you can see that many of them have emerged from the Asian region, from China, from Russia, and thereabouts. Of course, the last one emerged from Mexico. Another thing that is a fact is the speed with which these emerging infections spread worldwide. SARS, again, was an example. One day, a patient spent in a hotel here in Hong Kong, and within weeks, it was all over the world, or in many countries, all in total 25 countries. But coming closer to our present time, the pandemic was first detected or first recognized in Mexico in 2009. And here, this map is from July 2009, and you can see thousands of cases worldwide. Now, coming closer to Hong Kong, and these are studies that we did in Hong Kong, following the population of Hong Kong with blood testing. So in other words, not relying on people to come and report to hospitals, but looking at infection in the community. And you can see how that infection wave spread through Hong Kong, especially in young children. So as you remember, we heard about it in April. By September, keeping in mind that these are antibody tests, so there's a lag time to become antibody positive, by September, 45% of children in Hong Kong were infected. Now, later on, of course, there was a lot of controversy in Hong Kong and elsewhere. Was this all hype? Was vaccine needed? But if we asked any parent in Hong Kong or anywhere in the world, say in May 2009, there is a new virus out there. It is going to spread. It's going to affect half of the children in our locality. Your children have a 50% chance of getting infected. We are not very clear how severe this virus is at this point in time. Should we take steps to secure vaccines? I'm pretty sure that any parent, I certainly, even if I was not a virologist, I would have said yes. I would pay $100, $200, $500 to have that vaccine. So later on, there were controversies, but I think just want to point out some of the public health and communication challenges that we face, because this is an issue that public health and you in the media have to try to communicate efficiently to the public. So we have all these infectious diseases that pop up from time to time. Why are they continuing to come up? Because it was in the 1960s, famously, that the US Surgeon General said that the book on infectious diseases is now closed, because at that time, smallpox was on the way out, malaria was under control, many of the scourges, measles, mumps, and things were under control. So why is it that infectious diseases still are, in fact, re-emerging? There are many things that are happening that we are changing in our environment. One being intensive livestock production and the way that we market our livestock, raised in one part, in one country, shipped thousands of miles and sold somewhere else. The pet animal trade, you might be surprised to see how many millions of animals are captured in the wild and again shipped to other continents to serve this pet market. International travel and commerce. So, for example, in terms of livestock production, this just shows the increase in food production, whether it be meat, dairy products, or otherwise. And of course, this is good. This is important for survival. But coming with it are some of the problems, because this provides opportunity for infectious agents to thrive and spread. I talked about the pet animal trade, and that particular image there is a picture of two hawk eagles that were detected in Brussels airport. They were being smuggled through, amazingly, and when they tested these birds, they were H5N1 infected. And as another example, in the United States, monkeypox was imported into the United States through the pet animal trade a few years ago and spread, luckily not too far, but certainly affected 40 or 50 people. Then, of course, we have international travel. So all of us are getting on and off planes. So as of now, there are about 1,000 million of us getting on or off planes every year. So anything that arises here today can be everywhere tomorrow. And we have other issues such as changes in human behavior, breakdown in public health due to wars or disorders or economic turmoil. So these scientists, Jones and others at the Zoological Gardens in London, in collaboration with Peter Daszak in New York, they essentially looked at 40 years going back, looking at these emerging infectious disease outbreaks. They worked out what were the risk factors that contributed to these emerging infections to pop out. And then they went back and mapped where these factors are. So these four maps essentially shows the, in their analysis, the areas of the world which are at particularly high risk for different categories of emerging infections. So zoonotic infections coming from wildlife, for example, SARS being one example. And of course, red means the highest risk, yellow intermediate, and green being low. So you can see that certainly here, we are in an area of high risk. And vector-borne pathogens, so these are organisms that are transmitted by mosquitoes and ticks and such like. Again, in China, we are in a high risk area for such emergence. Drug-resistant pathogens, these are mainly bacteria. And again, this is an area of high risk for emergence of drug resistance. Zoonotic infections from wildlife, in a sense, that reflects something like bird flu, because that's coming from domestic animals. We are sitting in an area of high risk. So the question is, it is pretty clear that we are going to face new challenges in the years to come. As I said, they are likely to be viruses. They are likely to be viruses belonging to this RNA group of pathogens. And how can, from a public health point of view, how can we prepare? Firstly, of course, is generic response measures. So you don't necessarily have to know what exactly the disease-causing organism is, but you know the things you have to do to respond to a sudden outbreak of infectious disease. So surveillance, rapid detection and response, infection control capacity, clearly in the case of SARS, that was lacking. Ability to isolate highly infectious patients, again, a problem, an issue that was lacking. And when I say lacking, these were lacking because infectious diseases were going down in priority. I mean, if you had gone back 100 years, probably infection control and isolation capacity, even in Hong Kong, would have been much stronger because we were dealing with smallpox and tuberculosis and many things on a regular basis. And finally, of course, surge capacity, because when you have such events, you really have to, you have a huge demand on your intensive care units and your hospitals. So these are generic response measures, and to a large extent, speaking for Hong Kong, certainly I would say many of these have been addressed. I mean, may not be to perfection, but hugely improved over the last 10 years or so. Then you come to the second area of trying to anticipate or risk assess, and again, I would avoid the word predict, potential threats. And as I said, these threats come from animals. So basically understanding what pathogens or what viruses are out there in animals, and there are many, many. And then how do we risk assess these? Work out which are the ones that are more likely to jump to humans. And if we can do that, can we have preventive interventions? Can we have prior preparedness? And to address this second part, we really have to be honest and say that we know very little about, well, we can find out about the pathogens, the viruses that are out there in domestic animals and in wildlife. But how we risk assess which of these can jump to humans is an area that we know relatively little about. And this is a crucial area to for future research. And we'll come back to that later. So addressing the first aspect, the generic response measures of surveillance, early detection, I think one of the legacies of SARS really has been the recognition by all countries that infectious disease outbreaks anywhere in the world today can be a problem for the whole world tomorrow. And following on from that was developed the new international health regulations, which was formulated in 2005 and accepted by the World Health Assembly in 2007, every country in the world signing up to this. And the obligations that are clearly stated is that countries are expected to report unusual and unexplained outbreaks of disease. So in other words, outbreak reporting went from being something that was optional and something you could just hide under the carpet to something being expected and respected. Now, this doesn't mean that all outbreaks are being reported, but nevertheless, what I'm trying to point out is the change in the emphasis and the change in the expectation. And the second aspect of obligation to all countries is to develop the capacity to detect and respond to such threats when they do occur. So just let us take some examples. I'm sure you remember this particular situation in Cambodia last year. It was reported that there were little children dying of a mystery illness, and people were wondering what it was. Could it be bird flu? Could it be some new emerging infection? And Cambodia, of course, not a very prosperous country, not a country with very high health capacity or scientific infrastructure. They were able to respond to it. Fortunately, there was a laboratory on site, one of the Pasteur Network laboratories. They were very quickly able to identify the cause of this particular outbreak to be enterovirus 71. Now that at least is a virus that we know about. We know that it can cause this type of problem. It can cause large outbreaks. It has done so in other countries in Asia. So in a sense, one can count that or chalk that up as a plus for the international health regulations working in practice. And then there's another example, obscure disease in China. This may be a bit technical, but essentially these are patients, basically agricultural workers, who are coming down with a fever, unexplained fever, with changes in their thrombocytes, which are important for clotting. And this was investigated in due course. The cause was found to be a new virus that is transmitted by ticks. And the area where the ticks are endemic in China is shown here. So this is probably the area where this particular virus can pose a threat. Now, of course, this is unlikely to spread like wildfire worldwide. However, so this particular report was in 2011. And interestingly, in 2012, in the United States, they found a very similar virus causing a very similar disease in the United States. So this, I think, is an example of mainland China taking infectious disease much more seriously, enhancing their capacity to deal with unusual infectious disease threats. Now, I don't mean for one second to say that everything is rosy in the garden. No, but what I'm trying to say is that the last 10 years has seen some change for the better. Now, another aspect in such preparedness is understanding the importance of the spread from animals to humans. So when you try to deal with this particular issue, you come up with even a bigger problem because you are dealing with two different organizations, whether it be ministries or even at the international level, international organizations, two different imperatives, human health on the one side, agriculture on the other side, with the forces going in not necessarily parallel directions. I mean, this is economic and other imperatives. So it is really important in order to deal with this particular issue of viruses crossing species from animals to humans to try to look at this in a unified fashion. So of late, this idea, this one health concept, so in other words, we don't think of human health in a silo, animal health in a silo, environmental health in a third silo, that essentially we try to look at animal health, human health, and environmental health in one holistic fashion. That's the one health concept. Now, of course, it's very nice to say it, and nobody will disagree with it. Implementing it is, of course, a different question. But nevertheless, over the last number of years, the different international organizations, FAO, OIE, and WHO, have come together. And mind you, they were not always on the same page in the past, but they have at least come together with this concept, with the recognition that we have to tackle this together. And One Health is accepted as an important way going forward. So let's switch to another recent event, and that's the new coronavirus, the cousin of SARS, if you like, which emerged in the Middle East. And as you know, there are 16 human cases so far, and there's some evidence of limited human-to-human transmission. And this is posing some concerns. Keep in mind that when SARS emerged back in 2002, initially it was individual cases with limited human-to-human transmission. It took some time, a few months, before that virus finally learned the trick for efficient human-to-human transmission. So there are a number of important questions that need to be addressed. Firstly, how common is this infection in the affected areas? What we know about are the severe cases of disease. Is there lots of mild cases, lots of asymptomatic infections? How widespread is the infection in the Middle Eastern countries? And then the next important question is, where is it coming from? What is the animal reservoir? Because up to now, most of the infections are coming from animals to humans. What animal reservoir is this? Now, following on from SARS, again, apologies for somewhat of a technical slide here, but it's fairly easy. It's not a big deal. Basically, what this depicts is a family tree, all right? So essentially, each of these are viruses at the tip of these trees. So viruses that are close to each other are closely related, and viruses that are far apart are very distantly related. So these black branches were the human and animal coronaviruses that were known before 2003. And all these red branches are the viruses that have been detected since 2003, and all of those red branches are coming from bats. And here you can see SARS virus here, and you can see the close ancestor here in bats. And this is the novel coronavirus in the Middle East. And you can see that, in fact, when this was discovered, already it was pretty obvious that this was fairly closely related to some bat viruses that had been detected here, in fact, discovered in Hong Kong from the Chinese area. But subsequent work has shown an even closer ancestor, which is a bat virus from Europe, in fact, in the Netherlands. So essentially, the explosion of knowledge on coronaviruses over the last 10 years allowed us to pinpoint at least where this virus fitted into the ancestry of things, and also point out that probably the virus was coming from bats, but is there some intermediate host? Keep in mind, in the case of SARS, there were civet cats and all these other animals, small mammals, in the game animal markets that were important in the chain of transmission. So what exactly is the animal interface for this virus in the Middle East is of crucial importance. And I think in one of these articles that we wrote recently together with David Heyman, who, if you might remember, was at the helm of WHO during the SARS outbreak, we end that article up by saying that how the global public health and animal health communities respond to this recent emerging coronavirus threat will be a test of what has been achieved and whether the One Health notion can move beyond words to practical action. So let me move to some other diseases that I can see on the horizon. There's this virus called Nipah virus, which initially surfaced in Malaysia in 1998-1999. It spread initially in pigs, spilling over to humans, infecting about 300 people and killing about 100 in Malaysia, and it spread all the way to Singapore. But more recently, this particular infection has been detected in Bangladesh and in India repeatedly. And the animal reservoir, again, a virus jumping from animals to humans, is this type of bat. This is a flying fox, much bigger than the bats that harbor SARS and this novel coronavirus. Now, this is upside down, not because I got it wrong, but these bats do hang upside down, so that's what they look like in nature. So what is concerning is that this particular virus is also showing evidence of limited human-to-human transmission. There have been outbreaks in hospitals in India and in Bangladesh. Fortunately, still, it has not adapted to full human-to-human transmission. And interestingly, the route of infection in Bangladesh appears to be along these lines. So essentially, this custom of tapping the palm tree for the sap, which provides a sugary fluid, which is very nice to drink, is quite common in Southern Asia. So this is something that's common that goes on. And these bats, so these pots are put up here and collects the sap overnight. Now the bats come in here and they drink from this and probably urinate into these pots, contaminate these pots, and this is drunk without boiling. So that's how, at least one important route of infection. In Malaysia, it was a completely different route of infection because it went from the bats to pigs and from pigs to humans. So this is certainly one agent that we need to keep track of for the future. Then coming back to influenza, we had the pandemic spreading worldwide in humans, of course. And as you know, the pandemic virus came from pigs. So it was not very surprising that the virus from humans would find it easy to go back into pigs. So as this virus spread worldwide, it was also going from humans to pigs right across the world. And back in 2010, we reported that the pandemic virus was in pigs, but also reassorting or mixing its genes with pig viruses, creating new hybrid viruses. And this is going on worldwide, I would imagine. Certainly going on in our part of the world, and it's going on in North America. So you might remember that last year, there were something like 300 cases with such a hybrid virus infecting humans in North America. That particular infection, this is mainly in children, was primarily through these agricultural fairs. I realize this is far away from Asia, but I think these infections are global. And, you know, we talk about these very unusual situations we have with live bird markets in China and Hong Kong and Indonesia and whereabouts. But in North America, we have another very unusual interface. It is these agricultural fairs where there is plenty of opportunity for very young kids to come into contact with animals, which is great. I mean, I'm fully in favor of that because we really have to be in closer contact with our animal, wildlife, and plant world. But obviously, this poses the risk of transmission to humans, and that's what's going on there. But I think the point I want to make is we really need to find out what is going on globally in the pig world, because influenza viruses in pigs have changed dramatically. And these may pose a future threat of another pandemic in the future. Then, of course, the old friend avian flu, H5N1, it's dropped off from the news, but it has not dropped off from reality. It is out there. So if you look, these are OIE reports of outbreak reporting. You can see over the last number of years, it is consistently reported from Egypt, from many number of countries in Asia. And this just shows the last 6 months of last year, the outbreaks that were reported in poultry. And of course, wherever the virus is endemic in poultry, it is continuing to infect humans. And this virus has been there now for 16 years. At least we have known about it for 16 years. And people have said, well, if it hasn't jumped to humans and become human transmissible in 16 years, it probably will never do so. But I'm sure you're aware of these two papers, very controversial at that time, showing that the H5N1 virus can in fact be adapted to transmit potentially in humans. They were using ferrets as a model, but the ferret is a model for transmissibility in humans. So this virus can transmit in humans. So we end up coming back to this concept of One Health, the importance of surveillance, importance of risk assessment, and importance of evidence-based interventions. I shall just skip over that. And when we come to risk assessment of epidemics, or for that matter, anything, we are working with imperfect knowledge. There are some things that may be more probable, but have a less severe impact. There may be other things that are maybe less probable to happen, but have a much greater impact. I mean, I've just given the analogy of terrorism in here, a bomb in somewhere, and maybe a dirty nuclear bomb going off somewhere else. So where should we focus our attention? Should it be to more probable events that might happen, but probably we can deal with them, or more serious events that we will find very difficult to deal with, even though they may not be very likely? So when we come to risk assess H5N1, I mean, people say, well, everybody said H5N1 is going to be the next pandemic, but that never happened. But here, this is what I actually said, and many of us in the scientific community were saying. And if you essentially read the risk assessment, and this is done in 2007, there is no certainty that the next pandemic virus will be H5N1. The pandemics of the past, 57 and 68, were not caused by this group of highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses. The rationale for particular concern about H5N1 is not its inevitability of becoming pandemic, but because it's an event of low probability, but one of high human health impact. So this is, again, an issue of communication to the general public. What should we prepare for? The pandemic of 2009, even if we didn't prepare for it, we could have dealt with it. An H5N1 pandemic, a virus of its current virulence, we certainly cannot deal with that. So that is the rationale for focusing on some particular threats rather than others. So I think I shall just end up, and this is a slide from my colleague Gabriel Leung, whom I'm sure you know. And it comes from the Yellow Emperor's classic of internal medicine many thousands of years ago. And at that time, it was defined, or it was understood, that the superior physician helps before the emergence of a disease. The inferior physician is the one who begins to try to tackle the problem after it has emerged. Now, we certainly do have to be able to tackle the problem once it has emerged, but I think the greater goal is to try to aim towards preempting, understanding potential emergence, and preempting such emergence before it can come, or at least be preemptively prepared for such emergence before it actually arises. So with that, thank you.
Thank you for that fascinating review, Dr. Paris. And with that, we'd like to throw open the floor to questions and see who would like to follow up on that. Why don't we start over here, please?
Thank you, Professor Paris.
One moment, if you wait for the microphone, and identify yourself, please.
Yes, my name is Lewis Bowen, and I'm involved in a biotech company based here in Hong Kong that's involved in vaccinology. And I was interested, your focus was mostly on the influenza viruses and the coronaviruses, but you didn't mention much about the rhinoviruses and, of course, HIV/AIDS and the characteristics associated with that. And between those three broad classifications of viruses, which have caused most of the major pandemics that we've seen in the last 100 years or so, what do you think is the which of the three pose the greatest threats and the reasons for that.
Right, so you talk about the rhinoviruses. I mean, clearly they're important. I mean, all of us suffer from rhinovirus infections almost every year. But I think essentially they are mild by and large. Occasionally, of course, like any virus, they can cause complications. But that particular group of viruses, they have important economic consequences in terms of time lost or work and a general nuisance value. And by all means, I think, you know, therapeutics and vaccines would be very desirable. But the topic I was addressing today are emerging infections that can have a real severe impact. And that particular group of viruses, to our best of our knowledge, is unlikely to do so. But having said that, I should point out, and maybe you might point out, that coronaviruses were exactly in that same category before 2003. Coronaviruses were also the causes of the common cold. And people were not doing much research on it because they thought, oh, this is not a big deal, you know, so why should we spend big bucks on it? And then we found out to our cost that actually they are a real pathogen. So, you know, maybe you might have a rhinovirus emerging from somewhere causing major problems. So, I think pursuing a vaccine there is certainly valuable, but the reason I didn't deal with it is that. Now, HIV, of course, as I pointed out, everybody realizes it's a huge problem, and nobody needs to be told that it is a huge problem and a vaccine needs to be made and antivirals and things like that. So no question about that, no disagreements.
Okay, next. Back here, please.
Thank you. My name is Paul Christensen. Thank you very much for an interesting talk. I wanted to just touch on the issue of the impact and the response. Coming back to SARS, I've got in front of me here a thing from the SARS time, from the SCMP, so I'm sure it's a very truthful statement. From Professor Yuen Kwok-yung, who I think you know well. He said back then, I think in an unguarded moment, he said, most SARS patients died because of the serious side effects of the steroids. The 300 people who died weren't killed by SARS, they were killed by the steroids. Professor Yuen is on record as saying that. Now, to me, I'm not denigrating the medical profession at that time, because obviously they did the best with the information they had. But I'm concerned that maybe there's a danger of overreacting. When we look at these, you talk about the impact and you talk about the response. How can we be sure that we learn the lessons from SARS? I mean, firstly, do you agree with what Professor Yuen said? And secondly, how can we be sure we've learned from that?
Right, I don't have the quote in front of me. But I'm pretty sure he didn't say that the 300 patients died because of steroids. Certainly, it is true that in some cases the steroids might have prolonged the illness, and we know that certainly viral replication went on for a bit longer, and we certainly know that long-term high-dose steroids had other side effects. I mean, those are true. But I'm pretty sure he did not say that 300 patients died because of steroids. You can ask him. So I'm pretty sure that
they've had another 10 years to look at the evidence, I guess, since then.
Yeah,
but just to
follow on from that, I mean, I think we have to look back to that time. It was just a two-month period, right? Of course, we knew about this going on in mainland China, and the information coming from mainland China at that time, I mean, they were treating these patients with steroids, and if you ask many of the clinicians who dealt with these patients in Hong Kong, there were some patients who did benefit from steroid therapy. I mean, if you know how steroids work, because these are anti-inflammatory drugs, and the disease in the lung is driven by the virus and the inflammatory response. So it's a matter of trying to balance both of these things. Now, so that's the rationale for the use of steroids, and also keeping in mind that there was really nothing else to, you know, it was such a short time frame, nothing else at hand. We had our own colleagues getting sick and dying. The pressures on the healthcare profession were tremendous. So I think, you know, whatever was available, whatever was credible was tried. So I think it's fine to double guess in retrospect, as I say, I'm pretty sure Professor Yuen was not double-guessing that in retrospect.
Okay, yeah. Back in the corner, please. And then Francis. Behind you, I think you had a question. Yes.
My name's Jeff Chen. Just very generally, I mean, how big of a problem or potential problems is HIV in China?
Right, I mean, I'm not an expert in that particular area. I mean, I don't work on HIV. Now, clearly, HIV is a problem everywhere in the world. You know, certainly, we all know that it's a huge problem in Africa, but it's a problem in many parts of the world. And so it is in China, certainly some provinces worse than others. As I say, I mean, I'm not the best person to ask about that particular problem. I mean, there are other colleagues, you know, at the University of Hong Kong who are specifically working on that, and I'm sure they can give you a much better response.
Francis?
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Doctor, my question really has two parts to it. One would have to do with physical infrastructure, the other with what I'll call political infrastructure. When I happen to find myself in the recent hurricane on the East Coast in the United States and covering that, I was very surprised to find out and to see myself that there were parts of the sewer system for Washington, D.C. and the areas of Maryland around there that dated back to before the Civil War. So looking at Hong Kong, we're building third runways and bridges and all this other sort of stuff. I'm wondering if you have any sense as to whether we're, first of all, paying enough attention to our own public health infrastructure. That's number one. And secondly, on the political side, as we saw with the bird flu and SARS, it put tremendous pressure on the political system, which did not respond well, and was certainly one of the factors in bringing down the government. Looking at the government we have right now, which is, I think it's fair to say, not a strong one, what would your assessment be if we were to have a crisis now of this government's ability to deal with it?
Right, so there are two questions. Maybe if I can take the second one first. In terms of the response infrastructure, leaving aside the government per se, which I'm not an expert on, but certainly I would say that the public health response infrastructure in Hong Kong has changed beyond all recognition over the last 10 years. I mean, following on from SARS, initially following bird flu, but those were mild changes, but subsequent to that, there was the Center for Health Protection that was set up, a whole infrastructure within the hospital authority to deal with even reports from, for example, if you take the outbreak in the Middle East, within days, the hospital authority network was already communicating. They had put out preparedness guidelines to frontline hospital workers, and the virus had never come to Hong Kong. So, and in addition to that, the other hardware in terms of isolation beds is now well over 1,000, whereas during SARS it was very fragmentary, not very organized. So I would say that the infrastructure at the healthcare, both at the public health and at the hospital sector, is enormously improved. And I would hope that system would be able to absorb the shock of an unexpected event. As I said, how the political system responds to that is not for me to comment, and is not my area of expertise.
Thank you. One last question. Mary here, please.
Mary Gallagher, I came from Shanghai, and I'm of course wondering about the pigs. So I guess I want to frame it as a public health question. In Shanghai, most people are worried about the quality of the drinking water because there are dead pigs in the Huangpu River. But given that you're an expert in this area, shouldn't people be worried really about why are so many pigs dying in farms in Zhejiang? And I guess I'm asking whether or not, if we advocate sort of early response, is the fact that pigs may be dying of a virus that perhaps we're not susceptible to, but what should be the transmission of public information to the public from the government, and then what should people in the public do when they hear about something like that happening?
No, I fully agree with you that trying to understand what exactly is killing these pigs is important for animal health, for veterinary health, clearly, but is also of potential importance for human health, because we don't know whether this could be something, if it is one of the many common diseases of pigs, which is very likely, then the risk for public health is not that great. However, one doesn't know whether this is something unusual. So this is exactly comes back to the issue of the One Health concept that I told you about, that while these issues are in the domain of animal health and veterinary and the veterinarians, really they should be investigated in a more cohesive fashion with good communication in both directions.
Okay, and with that, I think we are just past 2 o'clock. We always like to give our guests something to remember the club by.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. And we hope to see many of you again either this Thursday or Tuesday, April 9. Thank you all.